I chose not to ask further. I needed space. Needed to sit in the guest room and hug my mother's shoe. Alone. Okay. I need some rest and a shower. I'll deal with my car in the morning, I said. The guest room had its own attached bath, a single stall shower, no tub, and a white pedestal sink. At some point while showering, a time that was a mental black hole from all the crying and confusion, I forced myself away from obsessing over my mother's shoe, which I kept in eyesight by keeping it on the lid of the sink and the shower curtain open. It took concentrated effort, but I had to stop spiraling into grief, or wind up like I did 2 years ago, sleeping in the fetal position for 3 weeks and not eating, not talking to anyone, and convicting the son of a conspiracy with the devil to cause me debilitating migraines. My sentence to the sun being to blot it out by drawing blackout shades so tight and stapling them in place. I never knew the difference between night and day. A psychiatrist tried to breach the barrier of my locked door in Rye to feed me grief pills, and I told the bitch to fuck off or I'd staple her eyelids. Then I launched the stapler at the door and made a dent in the wood. Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost sat outside my door the whole night saying her novenas, 50 rosaries clinking on her lap as she spent each one, either guarding others living in Rye, herself, my father, and the servants from me, or guarding me from others. I couldn't tell. I don't know why I shouted such violence through the door at the psychiatrist, or why I denied treatment. I think I said the thing about stapling her eyes shut, because that's what I was poised to do to my own self when the psychiatrist's knocks interrupted me. Simply put, it was a confusing time. Insanity is a well we might fall into, and with luck and hard work we might climb out. Standing in Auntie's guest shower 2 weeks ago, I asked myself if it was still a confusing time. I asked myself if I had forgotten some things. But even thinking these questions caused me to swallow the shower water and choke, so I had to think on lighter things. Like Manny. I didn't want to crawl out of the shower and submerge into Sylvia Plath poems again, allowing myself to consider how she stuck her own head in an oven. A logical conclusion. Think of Manny. It's okay. I switched to thoughts of Manny, as a gift to myself. Something I realized in Auntie's shower had always been an option, but an option neglected. And so the images and the questions rushed in. Did Manny ever call me at Rye looking for me? No one ever gave me a message, I think. I pictured his black hair. His blue eyes, his long legs, the birthmark on his chest, the birthmark under his right eye, the others on his arms, his thighs, his inner thighs, the creamy tenness of his skin like new leather, and swayed in the warmth of the guest shower, training my thoughts on him so as not to fall in the stall and sit under the shower head for hours, as my active mind wished to do. I looked away from my mother's shoe, shut my eyes, and pretended the white tiled wall and the wetness that steamed there was Manny's skin after a swim. I pressed my fingertips into the tiles and raked down, down again. But in thinking on Manny, and the fact I couldn't remember a call from him in 2 years, except occasional texts when we were at school, I wandered further into thoughts of my family home in Rye. And who lives there still, and who might have answered the phone and never given me his messages, maybe. I had to blame someone. I thought of Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost. I caught her once in my room, rooting through my drawer of crosses, the ones she's gifted me. I think this was about a year after my mother disappeared into the sea. When I walked in, Aunt Sister Mary heard my steps behind her and froze, bent over my drawer. She stood slow, removing her hands, allowing the crucifixes on chains and rosaries to lace like hair through her fingers. Facing me with guilty hands, which were glistening clean, as if she scrubbed them with Brillos every morning, she dropped her head to the side and sagged her mouth, contemplative, like a sad ghost. Although retired from the church, she still wore shapeless house frocks, hiding the curves of her 40-something female body, condemning her breasts as original sin. "Mary Olivia," she said as a confession. "Aunt Mary, please. My name is Mop." "I know, child. Yes, I'm sorry. It's just, well." "It's fine. Whatever," I said in apathy. "I don't mind you going through my drawers. I've got nothing to hide."
"But why do you not wear any of the crosses?"
"We've been through this, Aunt Mary. You know why."
"I know your thoughts on the matter."
"I'm sorry, but I need to get ready. I'm going out. Do you mind?"
"With a boy? You know, you should..." "Oh, child, I'm sorry.
But without Johanna, I mean, without your mother here, I feel compelled. I hope you are respecting your body and the church." I wasn't going out with a boy that night, but I wasn't about to correct her. I wasn't about to tell her or anyone where I was really going. They'd have locked me up if they knew. I raised my eyebrows. I didn't want to fight with her. But this was sensitive stuff here, her in my room, riffling through my drawer of crosses, her mentioning my mother and in the same breath, the church. It was all I could do not to push her out of my room and slam the door. I also brought to mind some snarky jabs Auntie Liv had woven into conversations about Aunt Sister Mary. Quick comments that she didn't give me time to react to. For example, when cooking a fresh whole cod once, Auntie Liv said, "The eyes of the dead fish, like the judgmental eyes of a rich, hypocritical nun." And another time, when I told Auntie Liv about how Aunt Sister Mary didn't approve of my swimming laps every morning like I do, she said, "If you were performing for her, the Grand Master of Approval, she'd be fine, I guess." "Hmm? You do your laps here, in the ocean at Haddock, in your wetsuit like you do. Don't monkey around her Byzantine rules, which she herself doesn't follow." She ground her teeth, crossing her own belly with both arms, hugging something missing there. And before I could question her severe reaction and the accusation that Sister Mary didn't follow every single rule and law in the universe, Auntie Liv said, "Enough of what's her name. Hand me the cake bowl," smiling away in her regular shininess. These comments from Auntie Liv came after Aunt Sister Mary left the church under circumstances that were never explained to me. And these comments and Sister Mary's strange ex-nunship were what I considered when I caught her riffling through my crosses in my Rye bedroom a year after my mother disappeared into the ocean.
"I'm sorry, Mary. Mop. I'm sorry. I'll leave now,"
Aunt Sister Mary had said, and fast walked out of my bedroom. And yet, she stopped in the doorway and looked over her shoulder, stiffened her back and wide-eyed me with her big green eyes like she does, like possessed, and said in a low hum,
"If you're to see a boy tonight, I will have to inform Philip, rather your father. And you know, I just have to say I simply do not approve. I don't know how to. The Lord has not provided me the ability. I must protect you from yourself."
"Who is the best to protect you from yourself? Is it you? Is it family? Is it a spirit? Who?"
Sometimes I think Aunt Sister Mary Patience Pentecost is the inverse of me. She seems to first think on practical facts, then dismiss those in favor of divine blind faith and grandiose meanings. She's like an upside-down mirror, able to hold the inverted image of me. Anyway, she continued, pressing her clean palms down the no-pleat fabric of her stiff cotton house dress, I'll have to report this to your father, and I'll pray to our Almighty for you tonight. You are so restless, child. I know your grief remains. Don't. Just don't. My father does not care what I do, and neither does anyone else, celestial or real, so you don't have to either, Aunt Mary. I'm sorry, but please, I need to get ready. I kick-closed my bedroom door and slammed the drawer of crosses in one quick series of motions. Not angry that she invaded my space again like she always did, which was annoying, but wanting to shut out in a definite slam any mention of beings living in my drawer, in the air, in the heavens, who might access my mother when I couldn't. I allowed Aunt Sister Mary and my father to think I went out with a boy, because it was easier if they chose to believe I was back to being a young adult, only about 20 years younger than both my aunts, and 18 years younger than my missing mother. Actually, you could say I was a grown woman of 24, so all of Aunt Sister Mary's fumblings about me going out with a boy was a lie of concern, and she knew I knew it. She just wasn't willing. No one was, certainly not I, to address the rabid tiger in the room. My mental state. I didn't go out with a boy. What I really did, as I often did when home in Rye away from my safe, obsessive study at Princeton, was drive my red Volvo to a state park with an old fort, also in Rye. It was always dark and closed when I'd get there, so I'd stuff my Swedish car on a side street. No one ever suspects colorful Volvos of anything nefarious, or, well, out of place, pretty much anywhere. Then I'd scrabble through the brambles that make up the barriers to almost all seacoast New England beaches. Out of the brambles and beyond the dunes, I'd enter the old stone fort, pretending it was a necropolis for those who died at sea, for the fort was 20 feet off the seawall. I'd imagined the current swept my mother's body from the Gloucester-Rockport line at Haddock Park and north to the Rye Fort. Such ocean physics seemed plausible in my grief. Grief was deep when I sat in that fake crypt in my made-up necropolis with a lit candle to wait for my mother to appear. She never did, but shadows did, and I talked to them, asking them to go fetch my mother. So did Aunt Mary, the retired nun, who still labored under her own crosses, did she answer the phone when Manny called and never tell me? This is what I wondered in Aunt Liv's guest shower 2 weeks ago. And then Auntie knocked at the bathroom door, waking me from my consternations. Yes, I yelled from under the water, still not opening my eyes. The mango liquid body soap scented in bubbles off my froth-washed shoulders. She cracked open the door, and with the vacuum of cooler air on her side, steam from within the shower whooshed out as though escaping me, preferring the metal mermaids in the adjacent library. Auntie whispered, "Manny's here. He saw your car in the Haddock Point parking lot. He's in the foyer. Please hurry. He can't be here long. Please, Mop. Please, please hurry." At least she didn't lie to him and say I wasn't there. This I tipped to the side of Auntie being the real Auntie. In reaching the foyer with a quick thrown pink chenille robe and matching coiled towel on my wet hair, I didn't care that I hadn't seen the boy I longed for in 2 years, and this is how I would look. He'd seen me growing up, with briars in my bangs, The time I got chicken pox on my face. The time I got a rash on my back and butt from poison sumac, and he did too, for we'd played prince and princess in the brambles. He'd seen me with braces, with casts, with the summer flu, and once with Lyme disease. I'm pretty sure we gave each other strep 3 times. And there was also the scare that I might be pregnant at 17, and thus my sleepless 3 nights, each of which he shared with me. I wasn't pregnant at all. I was just late due to overtraining for my annual win of the Haddock Point Lobster Fin Challenge, a 3-mile swimming race in the choppy Atlantic. I trained every morning at dawn along the exact race route. Several minor maelstroms swirl along this stretch. A person might get sucked up and spun if unaware. Perhaps you spin, drown, crash against the cliff edge. I preferred to skate my swimming body close to the sucking holes. I called my oceanic pool the sink. I entered Auntie's foyer in the pink robe and towel coil, leaving wet footprints on the wood floor in the library and the ice rink marble. Manny's eyes glowed when they met mine, and I wanted to cry. He rushed over and hugged me, but I didn't know what to do with my arms, so weighted by the thickest chenille sleeves, they felt 5 inches thick. The toe of my mother's shoe poked out of one of the kangaroo pouch pockets. Eventually, I did hug Manny back, but 2 beats after Manny's, and so our hug was, in retrospect, sweetly prolonged. "Why haven't you called me?" he said, not wasting 1 second on pleasantries. "I have the same question," I replied as my answer, looking at him sideways. Auntie, I could tell by my glance down the center hall, wallpapered in those colorful birds and vines, and to the kitchen in the back of the house, worked in a fury. Jammed boxed spaghetti into a boiling black pot, a meal that didn't require such an aggressive level of attention. The scent of roasted tomatoes told me she was baking the sauce like she did. "Mop," she yelled out. "We'll need to eat soon, so maybe you two could talk over at Manny's house tomorrow." This I slotted in the column of Auntie not being Auntie. The real Auntie used to beg Manny to stay longer, to join her in the kitchen, so she could prod us with questions on every minute action we took during the day, always keeping a natural smile and longing glint in her eyes, as if we were memory doors to her own charmed youth. I eyed Manny, using Auntie's suggestion that we meet tomorrow at his place as my own request, and he kissed my cheek. "I really miss you," he said, staring into my soul. I lifted my chin and saddened my eyes, confused at the depth of his words and the way he said them. Why, then, didn't he try harder? I thought.
"I have tried to understand your silence as grief over your mother. I do respect your grief, Mop, so if you need more time, I will leave."
He held both of my hands, rubbing the tops with his big thumbs, and he continued staring into my eyes with his own blue swirling oceans. "But," I stumbled, "but I didn't understand." Auntie's clock in the living room behind him chimed out 9 times. Waves of hot garlic braided with waves of roasted tomatoes, turning Auntie's house into a North End restaurant. My stomach punched my emotions and grumbled. I looked to Auntie in the kitchen. She looked out down the hall to the foyer, pressing me to move it along and rid the house of Manny. "Why is he sounding like I disappeared? He's the one who hasn't called or kept in touch, right?" "Manny, I don't know what to say. Can we please meet tomorrow? At your house. Late breakfast, like old times."
"On my back lawn with a thermos of coffee and cider donuts. You got it. 10 o'clock.
10 o'clock.
I set a tenuous kiss on Manny's cheek. He caved his chest as though swallowing the minor affection to his core, and left. Am I wanted? How could... That can't be. Dinner with Auntie was quiet. We ate at her kitchen table in the middle of her country kitchen, a place most newer homes reserve for Marble Center Islands. Her black gas stove sat on the side wall, like always. The bay windows on the two exterior walls still hosted green pillows for sitting, framed by yellow and green curtains. The view of the cottage from one of them did not show the cottage, of course. Now it showed the impenetrable tangle of vines and brambles and saplings and twisty trees. The floor-to-ceiling open antique shelving unit, which showcased Auntie's prized collection of yellowware pottery, was different. Before, it was laden with yellowware bowls and cups and platters and figurines, but now it was sparse. A few bowls left, one mug and a yellow Santa figure. I didn't ask why. Neither of us talked. We glared at our pasta in a mutual shell shock. Angry at the other, frightened by the other, bruised by the other. I asked one question. Where's Popover anyway? Oh, she said, twirling her spaghetti and looking around as if my mother's beloved cat were somewhere in the kitchen. He's around somewhere. When I stood to clear the plates, she said to my back as I rinsed the dishes and put them in the dishwasher, please, Mop, please. I'm begging you. Please do not mention my friend in the barn to anyone. I have to trust you. I have no other choice. I kept my back to her and ratcheted my neck in a roundabout way, like a fighter cracking knuckles to start a bar fight. We'd scoff, the three of us, Auntie, my mother, and I, over the implausibility that any of us would ever abandon one of us. How, if one were tried and convicted of murder, the other two would hatch an Ocean's Eleven-style George Clooney plan to spring the jailed one from jail, and we'd all three flee with fake passports to a villa in some southern climate. Didn't matter if we abandoned all the money and were left to make do with whatever cash we stole away with. So, trust me? She should have trusted me 2 years ago. Auntie, I said, turning and facing and meeting her one eye and eye patch, which she'd mercifully put on before dinner. I happen to know you. I happen to know you're not telling me everything, but I'm too exhausted over my mother to pry tonight. I patted the shoe still in the robe's pocket. I ate in the robe, too drained and starving to change into clothes. But please don't say all you can do is trust me. You shouldn't have to say obvious things. You shouldn't have to ask for my trust. This is what is the saddest part of all of this. Beyond the fact that whatever is going on in the barn is insane, and you know it. I think this is what my mother would have said to her. My mother would have slapped her with tough love in a way to say she still loved her no matter what. My mother was no scholar, didn't read the non-fictions like Auntie and me. But she sure was the one we both went to for the real answer and the never-denied hug. My mother remained steadfast in the whimsical and happy, and all she ever did was pour love or shop too much like a girly girl or write in her fashion blog, doling consolations to her readers to not fret over the dearth of fashion in Boston, for she had solutions. That was her job, love and frilly fashion. In many ways, she was my opposite. She called me her cherry berry reader geek, perfect as is, and then stuffed my face in her cashmere chest to smother me in love and fashion and kisses on my head. But she was the perfect one as is. Those of us destined to dwell in dark thoughts and doubt, In the dust of old books and in the misery of addiction to the topic of philosophy, we need bright, unencumbered souls in our lives. Otherwise, we slide with no balance, no foothold into good.
2 weeks ago, in Auntie's kitchen, after I called her out on the insanity of nursing a woman in her barn, Auntie hung her head, admitting defeat and perhaps saddened by what I was saddened by too. Her terrible suggestion of a lack of trust between us. The suggestion alone a rank betrayal.
"You're just like your mother, telling me like it is," she said. And before I rose in another anger at her for mentioning my mother, she shook her head and left the kitchen for her bedroom upstairs, beneath the alleged raccoon in the attic. That night in the green guest room, I couldn't sleep. I missed the mattress in my mop closet. I missed love. Missed my mother. Missed calmness of mind. Missed everything. About 2 a.m., I heard a chit-chaw, chit-chaw in the house, like a mechanical heartbeat. My body straightened in the bed, muscles sprung as if in rigor mortis, my eyes round moons to the ceiling. I'm sure I took no breaths for a good minute. Chit-chaw. It wouldn't stop. I swung my board straight legs from the bed and followed the possessing sound. Did I blink? I don't recall, but I don't think it possible. I crept up the long grand staircase and saw Auntie's room light on through the cracks of her shut door. The ch-cha rhythm continued elsewhere upstairs. Ch-cha, ch-cha. I paused, listening for the source. Sure enough, it reverberated from around the corner and down at the end of the hall that led to my mop closet room. We called this the minor hall. A second door to the attic kept the end of the minor hall. The other attic door was in Auntie's bedroom, which is off the main hall. Is the sound coming from the door to the attic? And is that door barred, like Auntie said? Because of a raccoon? I paused again to listen for the scrape of raccoon nails in the attic. But it's plush carpet up there, the only carpeted space in the whole house. No way I'll hear raccoon claws. What? I heard only the ch-cha coming from around the corner of the second floor and down the end of the minor hall. I slid past Auntie's sealed bedroom and moved only when the mechanical heartbeat resumed. Ch-cha, I slid. Ch-cha, ch-cha. I paused. Ch-cha. I slid, and on and on. I reached the corner and had only to poke my head around to discover the source of the ch-cha. But I froze, stunned by another sound that braided with the ch-cha. The labor of heavy breathing, which wheezed between each interval of ch-cha. I held my breath, hoping whoever sucked the world so hard for air had not heard me. And then, ch-cha. In sneaking a peek around the corner and looking to the end of the minor hall, I saw Auntie, her back to me, in a sheer white cotton nightgown covering neck to ankles. She fired a pressurized automated nail gun, nailing boards to bar the doorway to the attic. Lasering my eyes along the wall of the hall, I noted my former bedroom door was also boarded shut. For how long, I do not know. The nail gun in Auntie's hands must have been a newer model, for the sink of the nail under pressure was like a bullet from a pistol with a silencer. A soft ch-cha, like a heavy-duty staple into a stack of paper. Ch-cha. I magnetized myself to the main hall and held my breath. Cha-cha. I again timed my slide to the mechanical rhythm, this time retreating to the stairwell down to the marble foyer. In the moments when the nail gun paused, and thus so did I, a slight scraping, like metal on metal, subtle, rained down in nets of sound from above, from the attic. Didn't sound like a raccoon scratching at all. Now, 2 weeks later, I rely on the depleting energy of adrenaline, which isn't much given the blood loss. And I believe, really believe, an all-black shadow in angelic form rises from the ground at the mouth of the path behind the woman with the hatchet. My companion faints. I succumb to delusions. I must be dying now. I don't know if I'm dead, buried, blacked out, or in a complete delusional spiral. A black shadow behind the hatchet woman grows more solid. I suppose it doesn't matter anymore. If this is indeed the end and the black shadow is the angel of death, come to cocoon me in his yards of black gauze, which whip around him in this hurricane wind. Why do I assume the angel of death is male? Could be female? Could be neither. Maybe the death angel will seal me in an eternal encasement, arms bound, legs bound, wrapped in shrouds of blackness, alone, beyond the comfort of time. So be it. I don't believe in such things anyway. Or maybe I should, because I believe I am seeing something, someone. I'm not sure if I'm lying in the dirt still, outside the hole of the basement, although I do feel the drilling of hard rain on my back. The falling water could be a washing anointment, some universal baptism upon death, and maybe the boom I hear is not thunder, but is St. Peter crash-stepping in his asteroid sandals to join his comrade, the angel of death, so as to jointly perform my final judgment. I should be tipping the scale of myself and telling my thoughts they are impractical. I should acknowledge environmental and medical facts about my injuries and the weather, which might explain what I'm perceiving. But I slip, unable to gain enough traction to open my eyes, much less harness the hysterics I'm sure come upon this definite slide into death. Is that a person come to save us? Or is that the angel of death?
Chapter 8. Auntie. 2 years ago. I must be mad. It's 5 a.m. in the morning after I've been up all night, playing ghost in the white panel curtains of the guest cottage, guarding Johanna, because someone, and it has to be Kate Drainel, stole vials of pentobarbital from my barn last night. 5 a.m. I'll get this over quick, get back to my house and to Johanna before Johanna awakes. I spin out of my property, pass by the Wilsons off the main road. They're still in Costa Rica. I need to pick up their mail for them later. I drive 20 minutes to Danvers, to Kent and Kate's house. I want Kate Drainel to know I'm watching her. I want her to know I know all about what she's doing. I scrawl on the outside of the note I wrote her last night, the one in which I proclaim to be the brazen mistress who sleeps in her bed. I write, "I'm watching. I know what you did to Vicky. Stay away from me." The inside of the note says everything else, my taunting confessional about fucking her husband, but I didn't sign my name. So, how brave am I? You're not brave. You're a coward. This is insane. Go home. I'm not going home. I must leave this note. The note I wrote to Kate Drainel is in my purse, beside me on the passenger seat while I drive to their house. I should have ripped it up, but I can't. It's haunting me, poking out from an inner zipper, white paper against black silk. I tell Kate I'm the mistress in the opening line. I needle her in this note, how he doesn't tell her he loves her anymore, not without the stick of me in his throat. I don't sign my name. I just want to warn her to stay away from me, because someone, nameless me, is watching and knows. It is delusional to think this will protect me and whomever else she means to harm, but I can do nothing else. Stop! No, I can't. I must. Kate Drainel's ridiculous maroon minivan is in the driveway, right behind Kent's gray jeep. Why they don't park in their damn attached garage is beyond me. He sang to me once in his jeep, his thick hands on the stick shift, singing aloud, so unembarrassed and free. It was some country song by Martina McBride about finding mutual love that felt like home. I leaned across the seats and kissed the deep dimple of his right cheek for singing so unabashed, and he smiled with sad, in-love eyes. I think we were driving on our way to buy coffee, a sneak-away break, a stolen 2 hours from St. Jerome's. I don't recall where we drove, what we said, nothing specific. I only remember him singing as free as if the world condoned us being together out in the open. I turned my face and wiped away a tear of happiness. I loved him so much in that single moment. My heart multiplied into a million hearts, each heart a different fold of a heart accordion, which expanded and contracted in my chest. I love him so much. I don't know what to do. I have to let him go. I can't let him go. When he looks at me with those eyes, when his dimples deepen, when his hands frame my face, I want to liquefy and blend with his body, be his blood. What a fucking illogical bullshit thought. Get your fucking shit together. But his hands on my face, our bodies combined, muscles and skin. Park the car. Get this over. I park 2 blocks away from their Danvers Victorian. The June dawn offers enough light for me to sneak up to her unlocked minivan in nets of navy blue. I want to boil my hands in bleach to have to touch the handle on her despicable car. I know her shifts at Mass General as well as I know my own. Kent and I set our St. Jerome schedules to mirror, with strategic blackouts, hers, so she'd never be home wondering where he is, her idle mind lending credence to valid suspicions over which she might act. So I know her shift at Mass General is a grueling triple today, and Kent and I have the evening shift in St. Jerome's. This is usually the day we spend all morning and afternoon at the Kiss Top. It's the best day of all. After a whole day of lounging naked together, we scrub each other's bodies in the Kiss Top double shower, and no one ever suspects the scent of sex off us when we slink in to fulfill our evening shifts. But we won't be meeting today. Not after whatever went wrong yesterday with Vicky. This much goes unsaid between me and Kent, the words not having to be said over a phone call or email neither of us make. As I step up to her car door, a light flicks on in their master bedroom. I've been in it, forcing me to freeze. I can't swivel my head to look up and see if a curtain moves aside, allowing inside eyes to peer down on my naked face. If I were to flip my head up, she'd see me. If indeed it is she who flicked the light on, I stay stalled. If someone shouts down, I'll know I need to turn tail and run before I'm caught red-handed. I wait. I hold my breath. Everything in my chest and neck beats at separate rhythms, my heart, my lungs, each rib, my sternum, my esophagus, the muscles, a chorus of pulses in my body. I hear no shouts. I note the curtains haven't moved, and now the light is off again. I scurry to enter the minivan, pop the door open, they don't lock cars in this neighborhood, and leaning in to leave my note, get snagged on the seatbelt. I realize I haven't changed since my shift last night, so the damn pockets on my nurse's uniform and cashmere sweater tangle me up. I yank back, staying low, drop the note, and scurry back to the bush on the sidewalk. I catch my breath, watching the upper window, and no shouts come, no curtains move, no lights flick on. I hope this navy dusk of a morning shields my identity, if seen. I backstep in a trot to my car. At 6 a.m. sharp, Kate Drainall will enter her ugly car, where she'll find my note on the driver's seat. I plan to get home and wake Johanna to tell her everything so we can map out how to handle this mess and stay safe. More rides on this than a stupid job and my and Johanna's lives. Much more. Even more than my own sanity. And it has nothing to do with those damn pentobarbital vials.
Chapter 9. Mop. Present time. I question everything but love, which ironically is the most intangible, mysterious leap of all. But not really. Love is fairly scientific, and there are undeniable signs, instinct being the biggest tell of all, the one no one can deny. Otherwise, I don't understand how people hold such staunch certainties. Truly, I don't understand, so I feel displaced. Like something's wrong with me to doubt almost everything, which leads me to want to curl tighter to my safe spaces. My love of Manny, my mother, auntie, and books. I still cannot accept yesterday's shocking secret. Something I've been grappling with the entire time in the burned basement hole, and now too, outside in the hurricane, my companion passed out on my fallen legs. Still, love is one constant true source. The only thing I trust. I had a dream one night. That dream is the single clearest moment in my whole life. It was black and white. I was in a topless car as a passenger, Manny the driver. I don't know if we were driving toward our separation or running away, but a heavy emotion kept us silent. I leaned into him. And he turned from watching the road, one arm remaining on the wheel. The road was straight, no other cars in sight. I think the land was brown and flat, but we were black and white. He said, in a tender and painful tone, as if my answer would dictate whether he'd live or die, "What is the greatest moment of your life?" I smiled as my answer. A smile that said, "This. This is the greatest moment of my life." In the dream, he blinked in a way that swallowed his tears. He wore a crisp white-collared shirt. This dream sticks with me as a pure truth. In my life, in my mind, in my truth, that dream is indeed the greatest moment of my life. I'm not sure why I ever questioned Manny's love, when I know I love him. And I know how he looks at me when he sees me. That look, that starry out-of-body look, the look no one can conceal. I gave him the same look. A mutual instinct colliding, like two cannons firing for a 4th of July finale. Clear sky, no clouds, pins of stars, an explosion upon explosion of colorful fire, stitching the air with an embroidered heart of light. That's how sure I am of our love. I knew the second Manny delivered me his discovery of the true rose thief. How breathless I became upon sight of his sparkling eyes of excitement when he pushed a pine bough out of my way to reveal Mr. Fox Gilray's bed of stolen roses. I'm as sure about my love of Manny as I am sure I hear Poe's telltale heart whenever I read the description of its beating. Today is 2 weeks after I first arrived back at Auntie's, and so much has happened since. So much revealed, so many secrets, so many changes in our lives. One of those changes, which might seem the most severe, is actually the tamest by comparison, the hatchet wedge in my calf. And the woman who dealt the blow stands before me now with the same bloody hatchet, while I lie on the ground, cantilevered over the burned basement hole. My companion is still passed out and sprawled across my legs. My feet remain tangled in the pervasive knots of brambles behind. The angel of death I saw at the mouth of the path that leads here moves closer, sneaking in on the woman with the hatchet,
who doesn't notice the shadow draped in black gauze. The gauze flies around in the storm's turbulent wind, containing the shadow in a separate and slower rhythm of time. By the way the Angel of Death moves, tiptoed and silent past the creaking swing on the maple we call Big Boy, I wonder if he, or her, or it, I don't know, is here for the hatchet woman, or for me, or my companion, or all of us. I close my eyes, rest my head on a rock. I find a smooth spot of stone for my pulsing temple. The sky is a furious army now, helter-skelter with axes and spears of rain, limbs flying, screaming words of wind howling, and the sea threatening to breach the barrier of her foxhole and storm the field, too. Crack of lightning, scarring the green sky with green veins and unrelenting, a stab of the straight-on rain like endless icicles of glass. My arms above my head are sopping wet, but I feel nothing beyond wet cloth. I don't feel my bones, or my muscles, or the fat within. I'm armless, legless, helpless, slipping to the land of the dead. I'm dying from inside out. I'll allow the black shadow and flying gauze to handle this. I shut my eyes and wait for the end. And when I close my eyes, I return to the morning after I arrived and saw Auntie sealing her attic with a nail gun. I used a flashlight talk from my upstairs room at Auntie's, my mop closet, to my mother in her one-room guest cottage out back, tucked catty-corner behind the barn. My mother loved all things frilly and cozy and pink and blue and patterned in sea things. So Auntie made her that cottage. Plus, whenever my mother drank too much wine after any of their constant charitable events, she'd smoke a Marlboro or two. So it was good for everyone to give Mom her own little shack. Wasn't a shack, though. It was a beautiful beach cottage, shingle shake and outfitted within by Lily Pulitzer and the best upholstered furniture, straight from Zimmons in Lynn, Massachusetts. My mother's regular designer at the helm. Anyway, two clicks of the flashlight from my upper bedroom to my mother in her cottage meant good night. And three quick flashes meant, I love you. I would click out one good night, pause, and then click out one I love you. In return, she'd click out a series of 8 to 10 I love yous, until I would shake my head within my lit room so she could see me through the dark, and then clap off my bedroom lights and shut the shade, smiling as I crawled into bed. It never mattered how old I was. When my mother said she loved me, I was a child again, safe and full, and my heart felt strong and warm. Nothing in the world could harm me for the blessed seconds around the bubble of time when my mother said she loved me. When they called that awful morning 2 years ago, I was doing what I did every day. I was hanging my naked torso over the rim of a hot bathtub so as to read a book splayed on a white bath mat. Boomerang was the book, a financial markets expose by Michael Lewis. A phone rang, followed by shouting. My left foot collided with my customary cup of red berry tea, which thereupon spilled and ruined Boomerang, when I fish-flopped and sloshed out upon the screams of an emergency and to hurry. My lifelong reading routine shattered, just like that. I can't read in water anymore. And the sight of a Michael Lewis book makes me nauseous. To think of all of his hard work, which goes to waste in my small world. For I can no longer so much as brush the spine of one. I never understood until I lost her and lost Auntie how peaceful life was, how much I loved and was loved back. Didn't anticipate how looking at a flashlight over the past 2 years would cause me to fall into a heaving pile of tears. Didn't anticipate a relentless cold in my bones, literal chills in my hands that hurt. Still don't understand the chronic fog, how I'd find myself somewhere on campus, not having remembered one step of the trek,
finding myself standing by a fountain or leaning against a quad oak or staring at the fall canopy outside my dorm, confused, darting my eyes for any witnesses to the wizardry that transported me from my bed without my conscious knowledge. Had I been able to breach the boarded mop closet upstairs the first night I stayed at Auntie's 2 weeks ago, I would have clicked out an infinity of flashlight I love yous, hoping my mother would see my beacon in the beyond and find her way to the shore of the living. Instead, I woke in the green and gray guest bedroom on the first floor, a view of nothing but the basement bulkhead, and alone. The wallpaper everywhere else in Auntie's house is varied, patterned, of every color in the rainbow, and involving parties of every animal or fish or bird in the animal-fish-bird kingdoms. And yet, this drab, muted, green and gray room is the one I woke in. I suppose I should have fled right away, having seen what I did the night before. The boards on my mop closet bedroom. Auntie in a mad witch act of nailing more boards on one of the attic doors. Not to mention the unconscious woman in her barn in a hospital bed. The woman in her barn in a hospital bed. In waking that morning at Auntie's, a phrase floated through the fog. Something some doctor, I don't know, said about me, I think, some weeks after yanking me from my locked room in Rye 2 years ago. Selective evergreen amnesia. But 2 weeks ago, I didn't linger on the phrase, and instead laser-focused on one single thing. Love. Baby steps, baby steps, baby steps. One rung at a time. I dressed at 9:30, after hiding away in my guest bedroom since I woke at dawn. I ghosted through the mermaid library at 9:45, snagged a front door key from a hidden well within one of the mermaid bookends, slid across the marble foyer, and snuck out without interacting with Auntie, who clinked and clanked and hummed in her sunlit kitchen. I waved to her in running through her back lawn, to meet the side lawn and then cut through a path only Manny and I know of that hits upon, at some snaky point, an abandoned access path to the ocean no one uses. From there, and I could have done this blindfolded, I took curvy lefts, curvy rights, sharp rights, through the bramble bushes and vines, the twisted corkscrew hazel shrubs on both sides, and trees hardy enough to withstand the constant offshore wind. I didn't stop like I normally do to consider how these ancient trees look like arthritic hands stretching up through the earth. I broke out of the labyrinth of thin paths through the brambles to meet upon the granite rocks along the ocean's edge. These rocks lie in layered slabs, some as big as house roofs, and tiny tide pools pockmark the surfaces with worn grooves and cracks. The layering makes the edge of earth along the sea look like inland as a cake, and the edge a gray buttercream frosting dripping off the towering sides. Running to Manny's, jumping over tide pools and footholding in granite grooves, I ignored the low rolling ocean to my left, purple flowers growing out of cracks underfoot, and the knee-high mounds of bayberry and blueberry and pricker mounds to my right. The mounds thrive in a tangled mess before the taller brambles and vines and red-berried catbriar and white-flowered arrowroot shrubs, the boundary from which I broke through using skinny paths, which is the first line of defense for the inland ring of the corkscrew hazel and arthritic hand trees, which surround the innermost ring of maples and willows and perennial beds around Auntie's house. Rings of vegetation, each ring hardier than the next, form the layers of nature's militia. Imagine how defiant you must be to be a purple flower that pokes out of a granite crack at the ocean's edge, where freezing water beats and yanks at you with hundreds of billions of gallons of water and corrosive salt every day, twice a day, at high tide. On my way to Manny's that day, I stopped myself from wishing one of the purple flowers was the new incarnation of my mother in her next life, No, move on. That's not possible. I plunked down into the middle beach, for it was low tide, and kept my back to the cliff from which my mother launched herself. I climbed up more slabs of granite to Manny's estate lawn, and there he stood, A-frame and smiling, waiting for me at the tip-top, a green thermos of coffee in his hands. Out before us stretched his perfect green ocean-front lawn, the rocky edge to the sea to my left, his pool and pool house in the middle distance, and to the far right corner his brick estate, and behind that, the property's long-standing lighthouse.
"I love you," he said.
No waiting. That's how he's always been. That's why I love him. Such certainty. Such trust of his instincts.
Where has this certainty been for 2 years?
"Why didn't you call me?" I asked. He pursed his lips, looked up to the blue sky in a humorous contemplation, then turned a serious eye to me.
"Come over here."
I brought the blanket. And the donuts. Manny had laid on the grass the blue Duke blanket we had stolen from one of his brothers many years ago. This older brother graduated cum laude from Duke, whatever irrelevant year that was. He wasn't so happy we stole his precious graduation blanket. I think he said something crude about us using his collegiate gift for fucknicks. His stupid big brother mashup of fucking and picnics. Then he said something about how we could keep his fucknick blanket, now that Manny's jizz stained the letter D. But the stain wasn't jizz. It was icing from a cinnamon roll, courtesy of Auntie's kitchen, for she'd made them special for me and Manny. She'd placed 6 rolls, each with an inch of icing, because Auntie wasn't a barbarian back then, in a pink box she'd saved from some bakery, because she used to be particular. Packaging things with care, baking things and slathering things with ample love and icing. She didn't walk around with a punctured eye and no eye patch, and the thought of having broken gaps in her mouth would have made her own skin recoil before. She would never have walked around like a deranged woman pirate, hiding an unconscious woman in her barn. And as for boarding her attic with a nail gun, that wasn't Auntie. Was someone else. I can't even. This is so incomprehensible. Which is what I thought in actively blocking the thoughts as Manny led me to our stolen Duke picnic, not fucknick blanket. I took a deep breath to cement my intent on love. Just love. Nothing else. Baby steps. Breathe. Another deep breath. Manny handed me a cider donut. We didn't sit. We stood close, face to face. I took a bite and chewed while staring into his eyes. He mirrored my exact actions and brushed a hair from my cheek. The temperature became irrelevant, except for the emotional flash in my core, a welcome sign I was alive. Not like now, 2 weeks later, as my core cools. We spoke no words, repeating bites of our donuts, staring, and in microscopic involuntary moves, for we were commanded by instinct and our physical bodies, inched closer and closer. The low tide listened, calming the waves like hushing a brood of children. The water sounded more like popping bubbles than its regular bar brawl with the rocky cliff 10 feet off. Those cider donuts were freshly fried, so the scent wafted and hung in the grips of summer air, catching with the humidity and thus expanding, lending us a lovely displacement to the safety of fall in the dead of summer. I caught myself smiling, and thus felt myself emerging. And now, as I slip away to some other world 2 weeks later, I don't care about the haze of shock I was in. I'd give anything to relive a million times over my and Manny's reunion. "I love you," he whispered straight to my face, his eyes 1 inch from mine,
God, I love you. I miss you. He whispered closer, holding my face in two hands, brushing his lips to mine, but not kissing. Our donuts were done. My mouth watered. My tongue twitched. I wanted to make room in my body to swallow him whole and join his soul to mine.